From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The violence inside the New Orleans Convention Center was even worse than previously described, according to Christopher Drew. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times who has covered how the Superdome and Convention Center became death traps. He'll talk to us from New Orleans. Then we'll talk with reporter Eric Lipton in Baton Rouge about the communication breakdowns between regional authorities and the federal government that led to the delayed and inadequate response to the hurricane. Lipton is a national correspondent for the New York Times and covers homeland security issues. Also, we remember Al Casey, the guitarist in Fats Waller's band in the 1930s and 40s. Casey died Sunday at the age of 89. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The violence inside the New Orleans Convention Center was even worse than previously described, according to interviews conducted by my guest Christopher Drew. Drew is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, who is now in New Orleans, where he's been reporting on Katrina's aftermath. He co-wrote a front-page story on Sunday about the breakdowns in city, state, and federal responses to the hurricane. Drew covered how the Superdome and Convention Center turned into death traps. A little later, we'll hear from Eric Lipton, who reported on the communications breakdowns in government that resulted in the delayed and insufficient response to the hurricane. We called Christopher Drew earlier today in New Orleans. Chris, would you first just set the scene for us? Where are you? Where have you been staying?
Well, last night we got into the Sheraton Hotel downtown. It's the first time I haven't been on a sofa, an air mattress, or sleeping in a car or an RV in the 2 weeks I've been down here. And it's also a good sign of how much more quickly in certain aspects things are improving down here. Some of the big hotels actually got power back yesterday and have rigged up some temporary water solutions, and they're slowly opening floor by floor.
Let's talk a little bit about your reporting on what actually happened in the convention center during the storm. And you say that it was worse than we thought we knew. You say people at the Superdome were searched for weapons, but at the convention center, they weren't. Why not?
Well, the problem was there was no plan at the beginning to use the convention center. And all the people were, poor people in the city, were going to the Superdome, and that was supposed to be the main shelter. And as you recall, during the storm, a big chunk of the roof got ripped out. Water was coming in. They kept bringing people there. They ended up with 30,000 or so people in the Superdome, and everybody was sort of huddled back in the stands because it turned out the rip in the roof was right over the 50-yard line of the football field, and it scared everybody so much. I mean, nobody knew what was going to happen with the rest of the building. And then, as the floods came from the break in the 17th Street Canal levee, it basically surrounded the Superdome with 4 feet of water by Tuesday morning. So the city had to find another place to bring more people. They had to bring the people who were first people who were being rescued by the search and rescue boats that were going into the heavily flooded neighborhoods. There were hotel guests that couldn't stay in the high-rise hotels because of damage. They were hospital workers and patients from hospitals that got flooded out after the levee break. So all these people ended up being sent to the convention center.
You know, if they were actually officially sent to the convention center, it makes it more astounding that Michael Brown, the head of FEMA, didn't know they were there.
Well, it's totally astonishing that he said that, because I asked Mayor Ray Nagin here in New Orleans about his comment right after he said it, and Mayor Nagin said that for the 2 days that people were in the convention center before Michael Brown says he knew about it, that the mayor said he talked about how many people were there at a daily meeting he had with other FEMA officials and state officials. And so Michael Brown's deputies were at these meetings. So the mayor said if Michael Brown didn't know about it, it's just a problem of communication within FEMA.
What was the police presence like in the convention center?
The police, I'm not sure how many regular policemen there were. I know in the Superdome there were about 80 to 90 regular officers and a number of National Guardsmen conducting patrols. I never could figure out the number of regular policemen. There were some, I suspect fewer, in the convention center. But what was fascinating to me was I had an interview with the head of the New Orleans Police Department SWAT team, who was very candid about just how gruesome things were in the convention center. And there was gunfire every night, repeatedly. The SWAT team was called in by the regular police there, sometimes two or three times a night. He said that armed groups of thugs, 15 or 25 guys, actually took control of two of the six halls at the convention center and refused to let police and emergency workers in, and the SWAT team had to go in and retake those halls. And they had to do it without firing weapons because they had 15,000 people in there. And so they would go in there, and I can't imagine the guts it took for the SWAT team members, because he basically said, I mean, they would go in with full body armor and they had flashlights mounted on their weapons. But basically, when they saw a muzzle flash come out of the crowd somewhere that indicated somebody had fired, they would just rush the spot where the shot had been fired from with their flashlights shining in there. Of course, the flashlights were giving away their location as they moved in as well. And they would just try to grab anybody they found in there who had a gun or who seemed to be trying to run away.
Well, you write that the police captain said that the police department came close to abandoning the convention center and giving up on the people there. Because why? Because it was so dangerous for the police?
That's it. I mean, late in the week, it was just so chaotic. And the regular district policemen who were there, it was totally out of control. They couldn't handle it. I mean, as far as I can tell, I mean, people have talked about maybe the 300 or so New Orleans policemen who quit during the storm. Well, I was told maybe 17 or 18 of them were among the regular policemen in the convention center. The SWAT team even lost four of its 60 members, just couldn't believe they were doing the kind of things they had to do. But part of the problem was, in the Superdome, everybody was pretty much poor. But in this convention center, because the hotel guests, the hospital officials went over there, you had a really volatile mix of poor people and wealthier people or middle-class people. And so these thugs, it all started out with them trying to rob the people who seemed to have money and take their money and take their jewelry, and then it evolved into much worse. And the regular police just felt powerless. I mean, Captain Jeff Wynn, the SWAT team commander, told me that a number of regular policemen there told him about numerous women who had come back saying they had been dragged off by these gangs of 15, 20, 25 men and raped, and they would come back and report it to the police, and the police felt they couldn't do anything about it. He said some of the women would just go stand outside the convention center and refuse to go back in after this happened. And everybody was terrorized in the convention center. Captain Wynn said that when the SWAT team would go in there, I said, well, what do the regular people do when you're in there chasing these thugs? And he said they'd either be running for their lives or they'd be on the floor in a fetal position. And the other shocking thing, that when you think about the situation, the city's jail was totally flooded out. So they had no jail. And then when they caught some of these guys, they had nothing to do with them. They couldn't put them in jail. Everybody was too scared to finger them and identify them and want to testify about them. So I said, what did you do with them? And he said, well, the only thing we could do is just take them outside or take them to another hall in the convention and let them go and hope they didn't make their way back.
Now, you write that a captain in charge of the police was preparing to actually evacuate the police officers by helicopter because things were so out of control and so dangerous for the police. But they didn't evacuate the police. Why not?
Well, I think this was late in the week, and as they were preparing to do that and the SWAT team got called in to help with that, somebody finally got through the National Guard, because there had been no National Guard presence there. I think there were 300 National Guardsmen at the Superdome, but I don't think there were any at the convention center. And so it was just this beleaguered small group of police. So they rushed 100 National Guard soldiers over there. I think they came from the Superdome. I never could nail that down for sure. And they did a sweep of the 6 convention halls as soon as they got there. And they got enough order restored that the police and with the SWAT team and the guard, you know, they managed to hang on till they got the people out. The other thing was that in both places, you know, there was too little backup generation. I mean, all they had at both places were dim emergency lights inside the buildings. There was no air conditioning, so it was totally sweltering, temperatures well over 100 degrees during the day at these places. And so you had people, old people, at the Superdome, two-thirds of the people were women, children, and elderly, and a lot of them were infirm to begin with. So you had people dying in both places, not just from the violence, but just gave out. And the police commander in charge at the Superdome, Lonnie Swain, told me that Saturday, when the last people were leaving the Superdome, after they'd been in there since the previous Sunday, so almost a week, I saw some of them coming out, and it looked like the Bataan death march. They were so gaunt and dehydrated, but Lonnie Swain, the police commander, told me that a couple of people actually died just walking out of the dome after enduring those 6 days. And the bus is finally there. They died just walking out to get to the buses.
My guest, Christopher Drew, is speaking to us from New Orleans. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Christopher Drew, who's in New Orleans. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and has reported on how the Superdome and Convention Center became death traps. So, Chris, just standing back and looking at the big picture some more, where do you think were the greatest failures in the planning for evacuees at the Superdome and the Convention Center?
Well, I think there were big failures at every level of government. And I'm from New Orleans. I was born here. I grew up here. I went to school here. And my family is here. They all evacuated safely, but some of them lost their houses in the flooding, and some of them emerged okay. Amid the reporting, I've been going to check their houses. And what's just shocking and really disturbing to me is that for so many years, the scientists at LSU and other places have talked about how devastating a Category 5 storm could be. And everybody's known that, and it's just amazing to me that if you're going to put that many people in the Superdome, you know, you wouldn't have some means to get them out of the Superdome if the whole city started to flood. I mean, it's amazing to me that there wasn't more backup generation in the Superdome and the Convention Center. If they had been able to keep more lights on, if they had been able to keep the air conditioning on, a lot of these people wouldn't have died. And so I've pressed the city officials on that, and they all basically say, yeah, we should have done it. Part of the problem was the Saints want a new stadium, and there were actually some proposals to upgrade the Superdome as a shelter and have more backup power, and they were kind of held in abeyance while the state leaders decided whether to build a new stadium or not. But I think the other huge failure on the federal government's part, besides just the lateness with which FEMA responded, I think the other huge failure is that 3 years ago, the head of FEMA, Joe Albaugh, who was one of President Bush's campaign aides in his first presidential election, said that a bad hurricane in New Orleans would be one of the absolute worst things that FEMA had to deal with. And he and his people said 3 years ago, we're going to start working with the city and the state to plan better evacuation, better shelters, everything. So I sat down with the city's emergency preparedness head, Terry Ebert, the other day, and I said, well, how many meetings did you have with FEMA in the last 2 or 3 years? What did you do? And he said, we never met with FEMA. He said, they weren't involved in the preparations for evacuation and revising the evacuation plans at all. He said, we did a lot of work with the state of Louisiana. We did a lot of work with Mississippi on helping to get our people out through Mississippi. But FEMA in the last 3 years, even after they identified this as a horrible accident that could happen, never did anything to help the city or state prepare. And in fact, in terms of the delays afterwards, here the emergency preparedness director for the city never heard from FEMA on the weekend before the storm. He never heard from FEMA on Monday after the storm. It wasn't until Tuesday, the day after the storm, that he ever had his first conversation with FEMA.
Now, Mayor Nagin said, I heard him say this to Tim Russert on Sunday, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said that he told evacuees to bring food for a day or two if they were coming to the convention center. And then he expected that after that, the cavalry would come in, you know, the feds would come in and help out and help, you know, do whatever. Was that part of the official New Orleans evacuation plan, that people bring food with them?
Yes, and in fact, they've used the Superdome a couple of times in the past for hurricanes, and that's exactly what they've done, and the hurricane passed, and in a day or two, people went home. I mean, the idea of using the Superdome wasn't such a bad idea. It seems like it, given how horrible it was now. But when you stop and think about it, the storm had winds of 150 to 175 miles an hour as it was approaching. The Louisiana building code only requires buildings to be able to withstand 100 mile an hour winds. The Superdome is one of the very few buildings in the city built to withstand at least 150 mile an hour winds. It's got no windows. It's been up there for 30 something years, and it's never had serious damage in a hurricane. And it's, you know, in the downtown part of the city, which traditionally doesn't flood. So if you look at all those things, I mean, if they would have just put more backup power in it and stocked it with some more food, it would have made a lot of sense. I mean, where they fell down, and they did get food in. I understand the National Guard was bringing in MREs starting on Tuesday as the people's food ran out, and people were getting at least a couple of MREs a day there in the Superdome. There was no food brought into the convention center. But I just think if you would have had a way, if there had been more planning that, okay, we've got them in the Superdome, you know, normally they're able to go home after a day or two. But what happens if we get that really bad storm, we get the really big one, and they're stuck in the Superdome and the city's flooded and they can't get out? There should have been that kind of contingency planning, and there should have been more planning for either to mass buses outside the Superdome and in case they had to be evacuated, or there should have been more backup power to keep the, you know, if they could have kept the temperatures at a reasonable degree there, they could have kept a lot of people from dying, and they could have kept violence from flaring out.
At the time of the hurricane, Louisiana had 3,000 National Guard troops that were deployed in Iraq. Had those troops actually been in Louisiana, do you think the situation might have been any different?
My sense is that they could have probably deployed faster, and we've been trying to pin that down because obviously that's probably one of the most volatile national political issues here. I think there's only 10, 12,000 National Guard guardsmen in Louisiana, so it was a significant chunk of people. The state still managed to mobilize thousands of guardsmen. It's hard to pin down exactly what equipment. In fact, where the guardsmen normally stage in New Orleans, where their staging ground, they had 20 what they call high water trucks that are meant to go through flooded areas and help people, and the place they staged those trucks normally doesn't flood, and it ended up with 18 feet of water after some of these levees broke, and they couldn't get these trucks out. So here, on the one hand, we're all worried, legitimately so, about what equipment might have been in Iraq, but some of the equipment they had right here, they couldn't get out because of the unexpected levee breaks.
Chris, one more question. You grew up in New Orleans. Of everything that you've seen since the hurricane, what sticks most in your mind?
Well, I think when I came down from New York right in the aftermath of the hurricane, I really thought I was coming to cover the death of the city, the death of one of the great special American cities like San Francisco or Boston. And I've had such mixed emotions while I've been here because there are vast residential areas of the city out by the lakefront that because of these levee breaks are totally inundated with this awful, black, toxic, oily water that's just, you know, sitting there for 2 weeks already, and these houses are going to be filled with mold, and they're all going to have to be bulldozed. And, you know, I have two relatives who have houses in those areas. On the other hand, when I go downtown, you know, the French Quarter was hardly damaged. The big office buildings in the CBD just have a lot of broken glass, but not much else. I mean, the skyline has not changed. If you go down St. Charles Avenue and the Garden District and all the mansions that people like to come see, the universities, the hospital, none of that got flooded. All that's in good shape. And Jefferson Parish, the biggest suburb, didn't get hit with flooding and just a lot of wind, power lines down, trees down. But then I was out on a boat yesterday with a city councilwoman, Cynthia Hedge Morrell, and her husband, Arthur, who's a state representative. They were part of the prosperous black middle class that grew up out toward the lakefront in the eastern part side of the city. And we're going past their home. They had 10 to 12 feet of water originally. It's still 5 or 6 feet of water. The stench as you're going through the boat, I mean, we're wearing those, you know, white masks for what help they give, but, and they're passing all these houses and they're saying, you know, that's Norman Francis's house. He's the president of Dillard, and that's Judge so-and-so's house. And, you know, this whole black middle class, upper middle class, professional class that has risen over the last 20 or 30 years and that now basically runs the city on a political level, the mayor's house not far from there. I mean, all devastated. And I've been peering over the 17th Street levee because one of my relatives lives near there. And it's just the saddest thing to just see this black muck with dogs floating in it and just everything. And in this climate, this humidity, I mean, everything just gets mildewed and mold. And it's just one thing they're going to have to come to grips with is whether they even let people back into some of these areas when they get the water out or whether they just decide to bulldoze them completely.
Well, Chris, I really appreciate you talking with us.
No problem. I'm glad to do it.
Thank you very much, and I wish good luck to your family who lives in New Orleans.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Christopher Drew recorded earlier today from New Orleans. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He also co-wrote the bestseller Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage. Drew's colleague, Eric Lipton, will continue the story of what went wrong in the response to Katrina in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, journalist Eric Lipton describes the communications breakdowns between the regional and federal government that resulted in the delayed and inadequate response to the hurricane. Lipton writes about homeland security issues for the New York Times and is now in Baton Rouge. And we remember Fats Waller's guitarist, Al Casey. He died Sunday at the age of 89. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eric Lipton, has been reporting for the New York Times on how the crisis in New Orleans was deepened by the breakdown in communication between the regional authorities and the federal government. Lipton is a national correspondent for the New York Times who covers homeland security issues. He's also the author of the book City in the Sky, The Rise and Fall of the World Trade Center. Earlier today, we phoned him in Baton Rouge, where the New Orleans city government and the federal government have set up offices. Yesterday, when Michael Brown resigned as the head of FEMA, he said, "We're not a first responder agency. We're there to coordinate and help people prepare and coordinate in times of disaster. And so if the country wants us to be more, then we should have a great public policy debate." Now, Is that true that FEMA is now considered a first responder? And if that is true, has that always been the case, or is this a change under the Bush administration?
Historically, FEMA has been there to support local and state governments in the midst of disasters. They, you know, providing food, water, emergency relief. But during the Bush administration, there's been a stated policy that they want the states to play an even greater role in handling these disasters on their own. The first director of FEMA under President Bush testified to Congress in 2001 that he felt that some of this assistance had become almost an entitlement, and that perhaps the federal government should be asking the states to play a greater role.
Now, Michael Brown, who resigned yesterday, came under a lot of criticism for the way he handled the hurricane and also for not having much disaster experience. Now, he apparently wasn't the only person at FEMA who didn't have a lot of experience in emergency response. The union that represents FEMA employees wrote to Congress in June of 2004 complaining that, quote, seasoned staff members are being pushed aside to make room for inexperienced novices and contractors. What do you know about that complaint?
Well, if you look at the top ranks of FEMA employees, you have Patrick Rohde, who's the chief of staff, who was basically an advance man for the Bush campaign. You have Scott Morris, who's a deputy chief of staff, who'd worked as a media strategist for President Bush during his primary and also in the Bush-Cheney campaign. So, I mean, it's hard to argue that some of the top people at an agency that's all about emergency response, you know, that they're basically politicos, and, they did not have a great deal of experience in dealing with tornadoes, hurricanes, or earthquakes.
Now, your article said that because under the Bush administration, FEMA redefined its role as being subordinate to state and local governments in offering assistance, that meant that with Katrina, the agency most experienced in dealing with disasters and with access to the greatest resources, followed rather than led. How do you think that affected the coordination between state, city, and the federal government?
I think that the single biggest failure in the aftermath of Katrina was the inability of the state, local, and federal government to be able to commandeer enough buses to get people out of the Superdome and the convention center quickly. And for FEMA executives, in defending the time it took them to get the buses there, starting Wednesday night, really in Thursday and Friday in big numbers, said, well, we were not asked to help with buses until Wednesday. But, I mean, if you see tens of thousands of people packed into a stadium who are, you know, some of whom are already dying from, you know, the heat and the lack of sufficient food and water, wouldn't you already be requisitioning buses and sending them in? The FEMA, you know, they felt as if they needed to be have a request before they actually participated in the process of lining up those buses.
But why wouldn't the state or city have made such an obvious request?
Well, again, I mean, the state has some, you know, fell down here as well. The state, first of all, should have been able to essentially push a button and line up hundreds of buses if they knew that they were going to use the Superdome as a place to assemble that many people. But they didn't have a plan in place for how they were going to arrange for all those buses to evacuate the Superdome. So therefore, they were desperately calling around to all the parishes in Louisiana trying to convince the local officials to send in their school buses. And once you had the law and order breakdown, the parish officials were hesitant to allow their bus drivers to go into the chaos. And so the state initially tried to do it on its own and then desperately went to FEMA. And as a result, you basically had 3 days of people cooking in the Superdome and in the convention center and some of them dying.
Have you gotten a sense of what happened behind the scenes in Washington, what the debate was like within the Bush administration and within FEMA about what the role of FEMA should be?
I think, after this whole thing starts to unfold, as of Tuesday when the city is flooded, the big question in Washington was whether or not the federal government should essentially federalize the rescue effort and whether or not they should send in active-duty troops immediately, take over the National Guard troops that were under control of Governor Blanco in Louisiana, and essentially make it a federal response. And there was a debate within the White House as to whether or not that was an appropriate act. And ultimately, they decided that they were not going to do that. And as a result, there was a slowdown in the delivery of federal troops.
You read that the White House actually considered sending active-duty troops to impose order, but that the Pentagon didn't want to do that. What was that disagreement or debate like? What was it about?
Well, it goes back to a law that's been on the books for over 100 years that prohibits the use of active duty federal troops in a law enforcement role inside the United States. And the only time that can occur is if the president declares essentially a state of emergency and federalizes the National Guard troops and then can send in active duty troops to act as almost police officers. The last time that happened was during the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. But the White House was reluctant to do that, and the Pentagon was also reluctant to get its active duty troops in the midst of a law enforcement role. And the governor of Louisiana did not want to let the federal government control her National Guard troops. So this debate was going on for a couple of days, and as a result, the delivery of active duty troops was slowed.
Do you understand why the governor wanted to control the National Guard troops?
Well, the governor says that she did not actually hear this request until Friday evening, after she felt they had actually taken care of the worst of the looting and the violence. And at that point, she didn't understand why the Bush administration would want to take control of her National Guard troops. And she and her commanding general felt that they were in the best position to know how to deploy the available National Guard resources. And essentially, they were running the show, and they wanted to continue to run the show. They felt that they welcomed active duty troops to assist them, but they did not want to hand over control. I think that historically governors have been reluctant to allow the federal government to assume control of their own National Guard troops. It's a matter of pride. It's also a sense that they better understand where the troops should be deployed and what the needs are in their own state.
Now, Louisiana and Mississippi at the time of the hurricane each had about 3,000 National Guard troops deployed in Iraq. How did the troops deployed in Iraq and the equipment that from the National Guard in Iraq, how do you think that affected the ability of New Orleans to respond to the hurricane?
Well, ultimately, Louisiana was able to pre-position about 4,000 troops prior to the arrival of Katrina. Now, I mean, the governor herself said, if they had another 3,000 troops, that would have made a difference. Exactly how this would have played out differently is impossible to predict, but, that's almost twice as many troops. You could have had, say 4,000 focusing on rescue and a couple thousand focusing on law and order. So, I mean, it's hard to really replay it and to see exactly, whether or not there would have been the chaos that there was, whether or not the rescues would have gone quicker, whether or not those people would, 43 people would have died in the hospital. But clearly there would have been more National Guard resources to speed the evacuation and to prevent the kind of lawlessness that occurred.
What were some of the things that FEMA tried to do but that were either delayed or misplaced or went wrong in some way?
Well, for example, they have 28 urban search and rescue teams that are positioned in locations around the United States. They're basically fire departments that have specially trained teams. They only sent 7 of them to the region in advance of Katrina. And, that's more than, in fact, they almost ever send or perhaps ever sent before. But the warning that was issued on Sunday by the National Weather Service as Katrina was approaching New Orleans really was terrifying. I mean, it was, they were expecting a city that really was going to be wiped out. And not only did they only send 7 of the 28 teams, but it took some of these teams a couple of days to get into the proper locations. And so FEMA, FEMA had trouble getting its resources into the city of New Orleans, into some of these parishes that were most hard hit. And it slowed down their capacity to help the people that were most in need.
My guest is New York Times reporter Eric Lipton. He's joining us from Baton Rouge. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us from Baton Rouge is Eric Lipton. He's a national correspondent for the New York Times and covers homeland security issues. FEMA stopped some supplies from coming in. What can you tell us about that?
I think that it's hard to know exactly. One of the things I learned during the world in the aftermath of the World Trade Center was that there were so many offers of assistance coming in that it's hard for, you know, a federal agency like FEMA to know when to accept and not to accept those kinds of things, because what they have to do is focus on what they know they can deliver. So there clearly were many things that were offered to FEMA, to the federal government, in the days immediately following Katrina's arrival, and some things that clearly would have helped that they turned down. There was an ambulance company that was willing in one of the parishes to help evacuate and provide medical assistance that FEMA was not, you know, taking them up on their offer. New Mexico was offering to send in National Guard very quickly, and they were not allowed to move in immediately. And Amtrak apparently was ready to start running trains, we're told, but they were not allowed to for several days. So, but again, it's hard. You'd have to dissect each one of those individually to really know how ready were each one of these parties to deliver the services, and did FEMA end up costing lives or just preventing a service that couldn't actually have helped? And I don't know the answer to that right now.
You write that hundreds of firefighters who responded to a nationwide call for help were held up for 2 days in Atlanta by FEMA before getting to New Orleans, and they were held up for a couple of days of training on community relations and sexual harassment. Do you know why that was done?
FEMA says that these firefighters were going to go into New Orleans and other damaged areas to serve as community relations officers and not as rescue personnel. And so, therefore, they felt it was appropriate to give them this sensitivity training. It really infuriated the firefighters who were, you know, desperate to try to help in any way. And, you know, and then you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are angry because of their inability to reach FEMA and to register for assistance. So it's hard to understand why they thought in such a, you know, obvious crisis that it was appropriate to do that kind of, you know, sitting people down for days before they really got in and were helping out.
You write that the leaders in Louisiana were so overwhelmed by the scale of the storm that they were not only unable to manage the crisis, they were not always exactly sure what they needed. How specifically was the state or the city supposed to ask for help?
Well, one of the most important lessons from September 11th was the need to have an extremely redundant communication system so that, you know, almost no matter what happens, you're able to the leaders are able to talk to the first responders on the front line. That completely failed here in Katrina, and the governor and the state officials were not able to reach the mayor of New Orleans, the president of Jefferson Parish, the next largest jurisdiction down here, and so they didn't know what the needs were, and so they weren't able to ask FEMA, said to tell them, well, we've got, you know, 5,000 people in this neighborhood, we've got 10,000 people there, we need medical assistance here. And at one point, the governor actually went into Jefferson Parish on two occasions to try to find the president of Jefferson Parish, just to find out what his needs were, and she couldn't find him. To think that the governor felt that she should take the time to do that and ultimately was unsuccessful is an expression of the kind of communications breakdowns that occurred.
At the start of Katrina, you were covering the story from Washington, and then you moved to Baton Rouge and were covering it from there. Does the story look completely different when you're trying to see it from the eyes of the federal government and FEMA than how it looks when you actually move to Louisiana and start talking to, you know, local and state officials?
I think the thing that you appreciate when you're on the ground here is just the scale of this catastrophe. I mean, I flew into Jackson, Mississippi because I couldn't get a flight into Baton Rouge, and then I drove down, you know, through Mississippi into Louisiana. I mean, even in Jackson, it's you know, a couple hundred miles inland. I mean, it, just as you come out of the airport, you're seeing trees down, signs down, damage. And, I mean, as the federal government says, you know, this is something like 90,000 square miles of devastation, you know, are at least damage and complete devastation along the coast. And I think that when you see it, you begin to appreciate just how enormous the challenge was here and why, you know, logistically speaking, you know, even in a country as rich and powerful and, you know, as the United States, immediately responding to this as comprehensively as the American public would like and as comprehensively as the people who desperately wanted was going to be very hard. And I think it's easier to see that when you're on the ground here. And you just drive through mile and mile of area of damage.
Now, you're staying in Baton Rouge. Would you set the scene for us there and tell us how Baton Rouge has been changed?
The most different. The biggest difference here in Baton Rouge is just how overwhelmed it is. The city's population has been perhaps doubled or tripled. Even just getting, you know, down the street here is you have to fight. There's so much traffic. The city is, you know, the services, the roads, and everything else is just packed with people, as this has become a refugee town for some of the residents of New Orleans and many of the businesses. So, I mean, it's strange because here you are in a city that everything's operating and the damage is, there are trees that are down, but the damage is quite curtailed. And just next door, you know, literally, is New Orleans where the devastation is overwhelming. So, you know it's happened, but at the same time, there's a real distance between the two worlds.
Eric, you co-wrote a book a few years ago about the World Trade Center, about how it was built and how it was destroyed by terrorist attack. Of course, Sunday was the anniversary of that attack, and you were covering the catastrophe in New Orleans. And I'm just wondering what it's been like these past few days to be thinking about the anniversary of September 11th and at the same time to be in the middle of covering, you know, a natural disaster.
I think one of the things that I appreciate is you know, the sense of the overwhelming sense of catastrophe that we all had in New York on September 11th, and the question as to whether or not we could ever return to normal, and the sense that this was such a war zone in Lower Manhattan where I lived, not far from the World Trade Center, and you know, 4 years out, it's hard to remember just how overwhelmed we were, and I think that's something here that's important to keep in mind, even, you know, with a city like New Orleans that is now largely emptied of people and completely flooded, that look at where New York is at now and its capacity to sort of rise from such a catastrophe. I don't know. I mean, it's just, I think the thing that I reflected upon is just resilience and how people are able to overcome even things that seem impossible.
You know, in addition to writing about the World Trade Center and now covering the hurricane, you were also in Banda Aceh after the tsunami. So you've been covering a lot of disasters in the past few years. And is that making you feel either any more vulnerable or any more toughened, you know, seeing all of this human suffering and disaster?
I think it's made me more humble and also given me, you know, a greater sense of just how finite, you know, life is and how, you know, how much it has to do with sort of where you're standing and whether or not you're lucky. I mean, thinking about, for example, people standing on the 78th floor at the World Trade Center, the sky lobby where in the South Tower where the airplane was the bottom floor that the airplane impacted, and talking to, you know, one woman who's standing next to another man, and she survives, and the guy standing right next to her was killed in the impact. And you know, it's quirks of fate, I think, sometimes that is the difference between who lives and who dies. And I just have seen that over and over again now at the World Trade Center in Indonesia. You know, the one member of the family that's still alive, and every other member of their family is dead. And here, the difference between life and death is it's hard to understand. But it's something that I think it consumes people. They want to know that answer, and I'm not able to give them. But it's something that people want to understand why that is.
Eric Lipton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, thank you.
Eric Lipton recorded earlier today from Baton Rouge. He's a national correspondent for the New York Times and covers homeland security issues. Coming up, we remember Fats Waller's guitarist, Al Casey. He died Sunday. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you. no heavenly bliss. I never wanted a good night kiss. Then all at once, up jumped you with love. Could you imagine that?
The guitarist on that Fats Waller recording is Al Casey. He died Sunday at the age of 89. Casey had played with Waller from the early 1930s until Waller's death in 1943. He later freelanced in many bands and played with saxophonist King Curtis in the late 50s and early 60s. For about 20 years, beginning in 1981, he played with the Harlem Blues and Jazz Band. In May of 2004, we paid tribute to Fats Waller to celebrate the centennial of his birth. Our guest, guitarist and singer Marty Gross, performed Waller's songs. We also called Casey at his home in New York for a brief chat. First, Marty Gross and I talked about Casey. Marty, was Al Casey influential on you? How would you describe Al Casey as a guitarist and his importance in Fats Waller's group?
Well, it was no amplification for guitars in those days. So Fats was one of the few bands where you heard the guitar, and indeed where the guitar was frequently featured, either backing up his vocals or in solos. Al had got a lot of solo space on the Waller recordings during those years. And you just didn't get that with the big bands, and you didn't get it with a lot of little bands either. Either they didn't have a guitar, or if they did, the guy just played rhythm. So I think he was very important.
But there is one recording that Al Casey is very prominently featured on, and he gets to solo. What recording is that?
With Fats, that would be Buck Jumping, yeah. It's nice that he got the feature. He deserved it, you know.
Well, I think we have Al Casey on the phone now. Al Casey, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for joining us in this centennial celebration of Fats Waller.
Yes, thank you.
And with me here is guitarist and singer Marty Gross. What was it like to play with Fats Waller? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, it was nice. It was wonderful. It was a very good experience for me. It was fun music.
It sure was.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And how did you meet Fats Waller?
Well, our two families know each other. I met him through a part of my family. I known him in his playing, and his playing kind of got to me in a way, you know. And so I tried to combine both of them, his play and my play.
You know, Fats Waller was famous for not only being a great musician and songwriter, but he was fat, which was how he got his nickname. He also drank a lot. And that helped, I think, ruin his health. He died of pneumonia in 1943. Did you ever worry about his health when you were playing with him?
Oh, did I ever worry about him? Of course I did. But he seemed to be all right. And, you know, I didn't know that much was wrong with him until it happened, you know. And it kind of shocked me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know kind of did what it did to me.
Right.
You can imagine.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Are you doing anything to celebrate the Fats Waller centennial?
I've had a lot of nice calls and visits too, you know. And I haven't made it out. But I mean, I know about it, and it's kind of, oh, what do you know? You know what I feel about it.
Well, I want to thank you for spending some of this time with us.
Well, I want to thank you for having me.
Al Casey recorded in 2004 on the occasion of the centennial of Fats Waller's birth. Casey died of colon cancer Sunday at the age of 89. He would have turned 90 on Thursday. His planned birthday celebration will now be a musical memorial service. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Julian Hertzfeld and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
If I should take a notion to jump into the ocean, tain't nobody's business if I do, 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 do. Rather than persecute me, choose that you would shoot me, 'cause tain't nobody's business if I do. You can talk, you can rave, they can say awful things about me. I don't care what you say, go on your way if you doubt me. 'Cause if I go to church on Sunday and tear it down on Monday, tain't nobody's business if I do. I mean it, I solid mean it.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And from Working Mother Magazine, featuring in the October issue, the Working Mother 100 Best Companies, with profiles of each company. Online at workingmother.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Margaret McLaughlin about her experiences in New Orleans working with the ASPCA's Animal Rescue Team. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.